This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I am Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is J.P. Messina. J.P. is assistant professor of philosophy at Purdue University. He specializes in moral, legal, and political philosophy, where he addresses fundamental questions about freedom, authority, political legitimacy, and the like. He also works on topics related to technology, particularly the ethics of data science. His new book has just been published with Oxford University Press. It's titled Private Censorship. Now, when we think about censorship, our minds might turn to state agencies exercising force to silence dissent. However, contemporary concerns about censorship can arise in contexts where non-state actors are suppressing expression and communication. There are subtle and often not so subtle forms of interference that come from social groups, from employers, from media corporations, and even from search engines. Should these new forms of censorship alarm us? Should we assess them in the ways that mirror our typical views about state-enacted censorship? And if not, how should we think about non-state modes of censorship? Now, in the book, Private Censorship, J.P. Messina takes up these broad questions. He examines a series of emerging sites of non-state censorship, what he calls private censorship, and sorts through the normative, political, and legal issues. In many ways, the book is the beginning of a philosophical conversation about these new modes of censorship. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about, but we normally begin with our author and our guest, and we'll do that today. Hi, JP.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Good to talk to you. How have you been?
I've been well. Weather's getting warmer in Indiana, so things are good.
That's fabulous. You know, we normally begin with, the author saying a few things about himself. Why don't you kick us off that way?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in central Massachusetts. I ended up in philosophy through sort of a non-traditional path. You know, when I finished high school, I was working as an EMT and I had no real interest in going to college. I was what you might call a bad student in high school. It was only because I had parents that I trusted who hadn't gone to college who told me that I was making some sort of a mistake. That I ended up there. I ended up in a physician assistant program, which required me to take a medical ethics class. After taking that class, I found myself sort of hooked. And though it wasn't new for me to neglect my studies, now I was neglecting my studies for different kinds of reasons. So I ended up sort of applying to a master's program and a couple PhD programs, getting into Georgia State. I did my graduate work at UC San Diego with Eric Watkins and Dick Arneson. Then I went to Wellesley College for a year to take a postdoctoral research position. Spent 3 years at the University of New Orleans and have landed in central Indiana at Purdue University.
Well, that's fantastic. It's always, always interesting to hear professional philosophers who have a a mixed academic past. I'm one of them as well. So there's some deeper story to be told there. It's unclear how to tell it though. Well, good. So let's begin talking about your book, which I really enjoyed. And let's begin at the ground floor. You know, I suspect you'll agree that the vocabulary we deploy in talking about issues pertaining to what we in the States think of as sort of First Amendment concerns is fraught. And so when writing a book about censorship of any kind, and I guess especially perhaps when seeking to analyze what you call new forms of censorship, some of the conceptual terrain looks like it needs tidying up. So you're interested in talking about cases where there's censorship, but it's not enacted by a state or its agencies. Can you tell us a little bit about this distinction between what you call the new and the old censorship?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so in some ways, there's nothing new under the sun. So what I call the new censorship isn't brand new. People have been shamed and probably fired and blacklisted and deplatformed in various ways for a long time. What does seem new is our concerns about those sorts of things, sort of supplanting our concerns over more traditional forms of censorship, maybe in part because we've done such a good job, at least in the liberal West, of minimizing the traditional forms of censorship, but maybe because our culture is changing in ways that have increased the prevalence or the centrality of narratives about the new censorship to our lives. So talking about the traditional stuff, I think of a number of paradigm cases. So Charles Schenck, under the Espionage Act, was imprisoned for basically distributing a pamphlet that encouraged potential draftees to evade the draft, claiming their right, constitutional right against being enslaved. It's kind of an ingenious argument, in my view, actually, but he was thrown in jail for it because Oliver Wendell Holmes thought that he was guilty of incitement, that he was likely to cause people to violate the law, and that it was just too dangerous in wartime to have that sort of speech out there. You might also think of more contemporary examples. So in North Korea, information sources other than the Central News Agency are prohibited. In China, there's widespread internet censorship. In the mid-20th century, there were a number of prominent book burnings. And now it seems that people are concerned about censorship. It seems like narratives about free speech, its limits, and the degree to which we enjoy it in contemporary society are, you know, one of the main things that occupy our public lives. We read headlines about them. We see news stories about these kinds of cases. And yet there's none of the marks of the paradigmatic kind of state censorship, state-oriented censorship involved at all there. No one's going to jail. Instead, people are fired or sanctioned at work. They might be publicly shamed or deplatformed. Stories might be spiked by editors exercising editorial authority in ways that people find troubling. Social media companies can moderate away certain kinds of speech, and search engines can bury it, or in certain cases, there have been concerns that they just remove it from their lists of search results entirely. And here, like even with the cases of censorship that recall earlier historical periods like blacklisting under in the McCarthy era, these are happening in a relatively uncoordinated manner now. So, you know, there was a lot of state backing for the Hollywood blacklisting that went on in the later part of the 20th century. Here there are blacklists. So like Bill Ackman's firm Pershing Square Capital has recently asked Harvard to release a list of signatories to a letter concerning the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel for the sake of making sure that Pershing doesn't hire students who sign that letter, but there's no sort of coordination on the part of the state. And yet, I think people are concerned. We have congressional hearings. There are like wonkish policy proposals. This is an international issue. Bodies concerned with making international law or intervening, and everything's moving pretty quickly. So, yeah, that's a little bit about how I understand the difference between the long history of censorship across the globe and the current moment that I'm writing about in the book.
Yeah, fabulous. And do you think that one of the upshots or one of the effects of, as you just mentioned, that we at least in sort of Western constitutional democracies, we've done a fairly good job of sort of becoming culturally attuned to the dangers of old forms of censorship and curbing them. Do you think that perhaps one of the upshots of that is that, you know, when you hear people complaining about or lamenting or objecting to these new sites of censorship, it often strikes me that they intuitively reach for sort of conceptual materials that are really at home when we're talking about sort of the more familiar state-sponsored kinds of censorship, and that in some ways that tendency to think about the new censorship in terms of the wrongs of the new censorship in terms that belong to the old censorship kind of, you know, obstruct our normative analysis. Does that seem right to you?
It certainly seems right to me that this is a polarizing issue. You might have noticed. I mean, so some people say this is all hyperbole. You shouldn't be talking about censorship here at all. Other people say, yeah, this is censorship. And in that case, I think there's a sort of natural reach to sort of First Amendment materials for dealing with the problem. So you think there's like a syllogism: all censorship should be stopped. That's sort of what the First Amendment tells us. These classes of activity in the private sphere are censorship. Therefore, we need to update the First Amendment to deal with them. And so, yeah, I definitely think there, in terms of like the normative solutions, people are First Amendment drunk, you might think. They're unable to see that there might be sense in identifying things as censorious, but not much sense in extending the First Amendment treatment of censorship to those things. And so that's sort of one of the upshots of the book's first chapter, where I try sort of hard to pry these things apart, to say conceptually identifying censorship is one thing, identifying the correct normative response is something different. Now, there was another thing you said that I think I'm a little bit less sympathetic to, which is that, so one strong version of what you might have been indicating is that private censorship doesn't have anything really in common in terms of the normative concerns that it raises with state censorship or traditional censorship. And I think that's probably not right. I think that the kinds of concerns that you might have in the case of state censorship, the sort of thing that might motivate you to adopt a strong free speech principle in your constitutional design, or things like, concerns about promoting democratic deliberation, enabling people to uncover truths, helping them develop autonomously by themselves, and freeing them from the possibility of tyrannical abuse by powerful actors. And I think in some way or another, all of those concerns are still at issue in private censorship. It's just that they're also at issue in trying to curtail by state means private censorship, because many of the actors that are the censors in the private case are just exercising their own rights to expression, association, and protecting their property rights. And so there, I think though there are similar kinds of concerns, you almost can't sort of logically fix the private censorship issue without you know, sort of allowing for some significant state censorship or curtailing of freedoms that I think we have reason to recognize that private parties have.
Good. Oh, that sounds right to me, by the way. Let's turn to definitions, because as I mentioned, you know, at the top of our discussion, you know, some of the vocabulary here, even at the descriptive level, is fraught. So can you tell us a little bit about what we're talking about when we're talking about censorship? Part of the book, early in the book, I thought did a really nice job of sort of working through, in the way philosophers do, different ways of understanding what censorship is, and then raising some counterexamples, and then trying to, in that old, almost Roderick Chisholm sort of way, sort of chisel away to get a definition that seems to cover all the intuitive cases and give the right responses. So can you tell us a bit about what censorship is?
Yeah, great. A bit by way of preamble here, I will say that I started the book having very strong sort of intuitions that censorship was a matter of what the state did. And it was only by sort of reading and thinking through the issues that I came to think that this wasn't a hyperbolic response to what's going on in the private sphere. So for any listeners who are having that sort of reaction, I'm well acquainted with this. So let me see if I can say a little bit about the conceptual issues that involved here. So when somebody censors somebody else, there's this sense that the censor stops the party from speaking or stops somebody else from hearing what they say. So one of these sort of Chisholm-y principles that I come up with is just that. And I say that that's not going to do very much good conceptual work for us, because, you know, the doctor that takes out your tonsils to help you avoid throat infections and so on and so forth isn't acting as a censor, though they do stop for at least a period of time you from speaking, at least in certain ways, and other people from hearing you. You might try to say, okay, but that's because the doctor isn't, you know, stopping you from speaking by punishing you or associating your speech with a cost. But even if you were to change the definition in that way, you end up with these very interesting counterexamples. For especially for my purposes, where it seems like, you know, I teach college classes, and one of the rules that I have in my college class is that, you know, if you're regularly disruptive, if you speak out of turn, you end up with a lower participation grade. So I'm associating your speech with a cost for the sake, really, of suppressing it. But it seems like a stretch to me to think that that's censorship. Now, to say that it seems like a stretch to me isn't to say that everybody thinks it's a stretch. So Stanley Fish and Andrew Jason and Andrew Isaac Cohen both have views according to which I think that would count. But to me, that really makes it mysterious why we so strongly associate censorship with a kind of normative valence. That's not to say that all censorship is all things considered wrong, but it does seem to me that we mean to be talking about something that is, when we identify it, something relatively special, and sort of rules of order, like the classroom rule I mentioned, aren't the sort of thing that we're trying to talk about, nor is something like the exercise of editorial authority when it goes well. So if I publish a 2-page newsletter and I get 50 columns or something like that, I'm going to have to tell a lot of people no. But provided I'm doing so for the right kinds of reasons, it seems hyperbolic to talk of censorship in that case. Not only does it seem hyperbolic, it just seems to me wrong. What I end up proposing is that we understand censorship by looking at paradigm cases of censorship and trying to tease out what they have in common. So I won't waste a ton of time walking through the paradigm cases. But where I end up is basically that what the paradigm cases share is that the sensors are acting for a particular kind of reason. So I say in the book that censorship is the attempt to suppress expressive content perceived to be dangerous, threatening to orthodoxy, whether that orthodoxy be moral, political, or religious, or that is perceived to be inimical to the censor's material interests. And that's going to do some good work in trying to vindicate the intuition, if you share it, that the classroom rules that we use to make the discussion proceed in an orderly fashion aren't censorious. It's going to succeed in vindicating the thought that ordinary exercises of editorial authority are not censorious. Neither of which is to say, by the way, that teachers can't censor or that editors can't censor. And I have a lot to say at least about the latter in later chapters. But it is to say that when they're doing their job in the right kind of way, it's not going to look appropriate to think of them as censors. So I'll just make one note about the way that I understand this definition before I turn things back over to you, Bob. And that's that I understand a lot of this quite broadly. So I just had an Author Meets Critics event here at Purdue, and Aaron Miller at USC Law was pressing me to think that maybe the definition I gave was too narrow. And she thought that maybe I didn't intend to include things like the elitist censor or the distrustful censor in my definition of censorship. And the way that I was thinking about that is that the reason that the elite and the distrustful want to suppress speech is that they think it's dangerous, maybe intellectually or threatening to certain social or intellectual orthodoxies. So I really do mean these categories to be quite broad. And it's not clear to me that they need to be exhaustive. What I am committed to is the thought that, you know, not any threat to the underlying values of free speech counts as censorship. So another kind of response that I've gotten is, well, you don't do enough to recognize the respects in which things like propaganda and like content moderation to pursue maximal engagement threaten free speech values. And I think that's just because I do think those things threaten free speech values, things like democratic self-governments, government, the pursuit of truth, democratic deliberation, autonomy, things of that nature. But it doesn't seem to me that they belong at home in a book about censorship particularly. They seem to deserve a separate treatment, and it would have been overextending what I was trying to do to include them in the definition. So hopefully that helps give you a little bit of an idea about how I understand the concept.
No, that's a great help. I just as a side note, almost like I don't understand what seems to have become a common reflex in normative theorizing by philosophers and others to want the analysis of one bad thing to be of a piece with whatever analysis we would give of sort of nearby bad things.
Yeah, totally.
so that you know, your conception of censorship, although it is concerned with a certain kind of wrongful, you know, speech suppression or messaging suppression, it seems like it would strike me intuitively that it's a good thing if, at the end of the day, our normative analyses have several different kinds of normative categories for talking about the ways in which interfering with people's speech or messaging can go bad, and that they're not all reducible or sort of internally connected, so that censorship and propagandizing turn out to be kind of the same thing. That seems to me like it would be a very, very bad thing for philosophy if all the bad things were just one big bad thing. But anyway, can you tell us a little bit about why it does seem appropriate, though, given what you say censorship is, to think that, you know, censorship enacted by a state and censorship that is of this private kind, you know, you're committed to saying that these deserve different analyses, that are, you know, in some ways overlapping, in some ways connected. Can you tell us a little, to motivate that thought a little bit? Like, why is private censorship not just, you know, why shouldn't we think of it in the exact same terms as state-sanctioned censorship?
Yeah, great. So, you know, I think we should think about it in the exact same terms, in the limited sense that I think in very many of the cases that people are concerned about when they raise new censorship concerns, they're concerned about the thing that I just defined. Like, they're good at identifying, not always, but often, the attempt to suppress expressive content perceived to be dangerous, threatening to orthodoxy, or inimical to censors' material interests. So I think, yeah, great. That's really important work, and we really should recognize that their right to identify the things that they identify as censorious. So then why not go all the way and say, okay, well, what we need to do is update the First Amendment. We need to remove the state action doctrine and recognize that citizens have rights and enforceable rights against private parties not to be censored in the way that we sort of grant citizens rights against state agents not to be censored. And I marshal a whole bunch of different arguments there, but the way to sort of organize these is to notice that I think proponents of treating these cases symmetrically or identically are arguing in effect by analogy. So they're not just saying this is censorship, that's censorship, censorship here deserves this response, censorship there deserves this response. But if you really listen to what they're saying, they're making a somewhat more complicated analogical argument. They're saying censorship in this state context is wrong, and we prohibit it for these sorts of reasons, the sorts of reasons that I've already sort of alluded to above, the fact that censorship threatens our ability to uncover truths and to understand the grounds of those truths, the fact that censorship undermines democratic deliberation and decision-making, that it's inconsistent with autonomous self-development and individuality, and so on and so forth. They then go on to notice that at least in certain cases, and I think they're just right about this, you know, the private version of censorship raises identical kinds of concerns. And then they say, well, the right response to the state variety is prohibition, basically, and therefore the right response to the private variety must be prohibition as well. And I think basically, there are a few things to notice about that analogical argument. The first is that one of the main reasons that we've seen fit to really tie the state's hands tightly when it comes to speech is that government agents have particularly strong incentives to restrict citizen speech for the maintenance of their legitimacy and political power, and also that they have a particularly bad historical track record of getting things wrong. And when they get things wrong, people end up in jail, and being in jail is like a really bad sort of thing to me. I imagine, never having been there. But you know, in the private case, that's just, the stakes are low, right? So I don't think the stakes are, we should underestimate how severe the stakes can be. People can lose relationships, and they can lose livelihoods, and they can lose social standing and reputation. And that's all really important and worth taking very, very seriously. But nobody's going to jail. Nobody's under state scrutiny. Nobody who is censored by one private party is deprived of other avenues for their speech. And so, you know, one of the most threatening things about state censorship, especially at the federal level, and especially when it's done through the criminal code, is that there really isn't an avenue for it, because whatever avenue you might choose, if you're found to violate the censor's rules, you are going to be punished. If Meta blocks me from its platforms, I can try Truth or Twitter. If all of them block me, I can start a blog. I can go to the town square and try to make my case there. I can talk to family and friends openly and without fear of formal punishment. And if those friends and family members dissociate from me, I can find others. If no ISP is willing to host my blog. I can pay for my own server space and so on and so forth. So another part of it is that we have alternatives to any particular private forum for our speech. Whereas at least in the sort of paradigm cases of censorship that really motivate the idea that we've got to stop it, that's just not going to be the case. And then the final thing that I say in the book is that, you know, you really have to take seriously this thing that I've already alluded to, that a lot of the private parties that are acting as censors in the private censorship case have rights to association and speech and property that states just constitutively lack, right? So it is, at least prima facie, a violation of my right to the freedom of association if the state tells me that I have to work with or associate with someone against my will, if they say that my bulletin board or something has to host somebody else's words that I might find objectionable for very good reason against my will. It is a violation of potentially my expressive freedom if I, as the owner of a media corporation, have to host content that is inimical to my way of seeing the world. And we don't tend to think that the state has similar kinds of interests. And so I just reject that it's a good idea to argue, to conclude from the respects in which state censorship and private censorship are similar, to the conclusion that we should be treating them the same way. I really think even in cases where they get closest, which are cases where private power looks monopolistic and the competitive environment is looking not so competitive, even then, I think the remedies that we're looking at won't resemble in any straightforward way the First Amendment solution to the problem of public censorship.
Fantastic. So let's pick up. You've alluded a couple of times to what strikes me as a kind of normative core of the entire book, which is an account of a public sphere and speech and information environment that's worth valuing in a democratic society. So at the core, that is, of the book, you give an account of, of what sort of free speech communication expression system is most important for democratic societies, and the ways in which that system, that ecosystem, so to speak, can be polluted by bad speech. Can you tell us a little bit about that strikes me as sort of a central piece of normative analysis for the rest of the book. So lay that out.
Yeah, great. So I'm not the first to think of things in this way. So Rishi Joshi has a book, Why It's Okay to Speak Your Mind, where he sort of conceives of the environment that we have in which we express ourselves as a kind of epistemic commons. So, you know, one of the arguments that he gives is that when some people fail to speak their mind and provide their evidence on various matters of common concern, they do so often in the hopes that other people will speak up with similar things for them. And so there's a kind of free rider problem there. More generally, I think that, we're missing something important if we ignore that there's such a thing as like free speech or First Amendment culture that's an important supplement to whatever legal apparatus we do want to instantiate. And that culture involves, for me and my understanding, an atmosphere in which on a broad range of issues of common concern, really in that range, by the way, we can talk a little bit about how to think about it. I don't say a whole lot in the book about the range, but on a broad range of issues, people, citizens, human beings are free and feel free to speak without fear that they're going to face, really powerful sanctions for their speech. we want an environment too, though, where you know, people where the speech is responsible in that sphere. So we, you know, there's a worry that has been raised for a very long time that certain kinds of speech, discriminatory speech and incivility, politically incorrect speech in certain ways, can lead people to check out of the conversation. So another thing that we want out of our speech environment is that it be inclusive and that it not be so polluted with discriminatory speech and harassment and incivility that well-meaning people who have things to say aren't just checking out, though they might not be sort of censored for it. They're led to think that they don't belong in the conversation and that their opinion, even if it were expressed, wouldn't be heard or taken seriously. They would be sort of thought as representatives of certain groups that don't have enough sort of social standing to be heard and taken seriously. That's something that we should be concerned with. We should also be concerned, I think, to have an environment where it's okay to have and express unpopular ideas. So, you know, I really think that it's a good thing to some degree if people are, holdouts to theories that are discredited and that they can express and give arguments for them without fear of significant sanction. Because if they're not, then, you know, we have this sort of view, which I think is an implausible view, that that progress is linear and that we never make missteps. And even if that view were right, by the way, and we didn't make any missteps, that we couldn't learn things or help people along in their understanding by allowing them to express their views without sanction, without fear of significant sanction. And so, you know, one of the so the categories of pollutants that I talk about are discriminatory speech and harassment, things that threaten people's reputation and good standing in the community, might lead people to check out, mis and disinformation. So we also want, by the way, my love for falsehood and false speech notwithstanding, an environment where people are able to coordinate on the right theories and the best theories when action urgently requires that they do so. And sometimes misinformation and disinformation really do stand in the way of that. So that's another sort of pollutant. I talk about incivility. So, you know, I think lots of people, there's at least a view that I think is quite plausible that there are a whole bunch of folks that are sort of moderate, in the middle of the spectrum, who aren't really engaging in much political speech and aren't doing much political listening, because they see that there's really no place for them, and they're tired of extreme speech and punitive speech on both sides of the political spectrum, and that's not great, because it can basically reinforce effective polarization and lead our democratic societies into some pretty bad and underrepresentative decision-making spaces. So the thing to notice about all of this is that a lot of the kinds of bad speech that I just listed are also the sorts of things that compromise the sorts of things that compromise are the sort of free speech environment that I just described. So they give you pro tanto reasons to intervene there and interfere with other people's speech where doing so is going to be effective. And what I notice about that is that it makes a great deal of sense about the way that we're talking about private censorship. So some people are talking about private censorship as what they call accountability culture. So you say and do bad things, you're going to be held accountable. And it's not apt to say or raise the concern about censorship when that's so. And then on the other side, you're noticing, well, censorship itself can compromise by associating speech with punishment, our environment for free speech or free speech culture. And they're both to a substantial degree correct. So I think that, you know, sometimes censorship appears as a mechanism for protecting a vital common resource. And sometimes it appears as a threat to that same resource. And so by kind of clarifying this at the level of reasons, what I try to suggest is that While it's true that censorship is often a sort of apt response to bad speech, it's also governed by an effectiveness constraint. And there are a bunch of reasons to worry about the ability for uncoordinated groups and individuals to act effectively as censors without inviting significant costs as side effects, or actually promoting or amplifying the speech that they intend to suppress. So that's a little bit about the
Streisand effect. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good. Perfect. So once you set up this sort of framework, you know, thinking about what censorship is, you know, what sort of speech environment is worth valuing in a democratic society. Oh, the book turns to some salient sites of private censorship. And you begin with employers' efforts to censor employees' speech and expression. Can you tell us a little bit about that analysis?
Yeah, great. So the chapter on employment and workplace censorship starts with the story of David Shore, who is an analyst for Civis Analytics. And he was let go. The details are controversial because Civis Analytics leadership disputes certain elements of the story that went public. But in any case, a stylized version of the case is that he's let go after tweeting in the wake of the George Floyd killing, which is horrific. A paper by Omar Wasso that was published in the APSR on different reactions to injustice, violent and nonviolent, and their effect on vote shares of the Democratic and Republican Party. And so, you know, he's one of these cases where a bunch of people on Twitter respond, accuse him of some pretty vicious wrongdoing. And eventually his employer responds, at least allegedly, by asking him to leave and go elsewhere. And so I wonder, like, what should we think about that kind of case? And a lot's going to hang on the precise details of the reasons. That's as we should expect, given that my conception of censorship does depend on what's kind of in the heads of the censors. But on many analyses, I think employers that act in this way are depleting this kind of common resource that we have reason to value by making it even harder to talk about some things that are already really hard to talk about. And I think that's probably true in the David Shore case, as I indicate toward the end of the chapter. But if you want a different kind of case that's coded in a completely different way, let's go back to the Bill Ackman case. And notice that there, what Ackman is basically doing is calling on corporate leaders and calling on Harvard University to, you know, blacklist students who are engaging in controversial, I think, if you're asking me my own view, misguided speech in their capacity as university students. And I think that they're, you know, we really want young people to be able to experiment with ideas, even misguided ones, without having to worry about their future being completely, being sent completely off the rails by their choices. And I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and I feel bad for a lot of the students that are growing up in today's environment. So Ackman and some other corporate leaders says, release the list of signatories. I'm not hiring any of these people, and my corporate friends in asset management shouldn't either. Maybe more broadly shouldn't either. And then, you know, the stakes get raised because trucks containing electronic billboards that have the faces and names of signatories are rolling through the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I think this is all prima facie pretty bad for our speech environment. It's not the sort of thing that I think we should address through law, though there are plenty of people, Brian Berry, perhaps most notably, who would disagree with me on that point. But here's the general way that I analyze cases like this, right? So following Supreme Court doctrine and sort of extending it in ways that they don't, I distinguish between intimate firms and expressive firms. So a firm is intimate when it has relatively small membership, is pretty selective in determining membership, when its central activities are restricted to members, when it has relatively low rates of turnover, and when there's a lot of sort of interaction between its members on a day-to-day basis. An expressive firm is a firm that's constituted to serve some expressive purpose. So a media organization or a nonprofit that's geared at solving some mission-oriented problem might count as an expressive firm as well. And what I say is that either being intimate or expressive gives us very strong moral reasons not to interfere with their associational decisions. By interference there, I mean legal interference. Right. But, you know, I think in the Ackman case and in the Civis Analytics case, where I think either or both of these conditions are met, so Pershing Square Capital is intimate and Civis Analytics might be intimate and expressive, both, they have this sort of legal right, and they ought to have this sort of legal right to act in the way that they do. But man, should we be concerned about their decisions, because they are making it much more difficult to have frank conversations in a deeply polarized context by raising the stakes of expressing views on those kinds of issues of common concern. And that's something that just can't be good for our collective ability to think things through in the way that we should want.
Right. Good. So you have three chapters then that deal with various sort of communication intermediaries, the press, social media platforms, and then ultimately search engines. Can we talk a little bit about your account of the press and editorial power as a potential site of private censorship?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the press is experiencing a legitimacy crisis. So, you know, levels of distrust in media are relatively higher, although not quite as much higher as you might think with all of the complaints about the fake news media. But, you know, people across the political spectrum to some degree are concerned about narrative and spin, and they yearn for a press that just reports the facts, and they, you know, contemplate things like a return to the fairness doctrine and various different measures that would really enforce what they see as a good norm of journalistic integrity, which is balance and fairness in reporting and refraining from editorializing when reporting news. And I have some sympathy with those views, but at the end of the day, I think we confront so much information in our lives, and there's so much information out there that we don't confront, that to some substantial degree, we need filtering, sorting, and interpretation from media organizations. And to have good sorting, filtering, and interpretation for media organizations, they need to be able to make choices about what's important, about why it's important, about what's important about it. And all of that means that they need to be independent to make those kinds of decisions, because those are judgments that don't concern merely the facts, but concern values and what and rankings of priorities. So I think editorial independence is really important. I also think that once you have editorial independence, unfortunately, you have a situation where editors who have the concerns of censors can abuse their independence to spike stories that really are important to protect their political interests or to promote political or moral narratives, that can spike stories to protect their material interests by appeasing advertisers. So one of the stories that I like most on this front is that there was a syndicated story in the mid 20th century about how to make your own soap at home, and various advertisers forced or threatened to pull funding if outlets ran this story. Because why? Well, they didn't want to lose market for soap after people realized that it was quite easy to make at home. I don't know if that was a really reasonable concern. I have no interest in making my own soap, but maybe I'm different. Right. And so on my definition, those things all count as censorship. And I think that, you know, in various cases, they count as wrongful censorship, right? Those are two separate questions, by the way, on my account. And so what should we do about that? Should we return to the fairness doctrine? Should we regulate the press? Should we, should we revitalize journalistic norms? Some combination of these things. And where I end up coming down is that we best approach or mitigate the damage that the possibility of editorial censorship can do by making sure that we have a media environment that relies on a variety of funding sources, that is intellectually diverse, that has competing interests. So I wouldn't turn away from a model of journalism that and journalism outlets that rely on ad revenue, because I think people have pointed out that that can actually provide some pretty good incentives in certain cases. But I think we're over reliant. I would want to see some philanthropic organizations and maybe some government organizations endowing genuinely independent sources of journalism, especially in local contexts. Education partnerships between journalistic enterprises and scientific research organizations to improve the quality of scientific journalism. And the hope, I guess, is that if you've got a properly competitive environment where everybody's serving a different master and some are serving no master at all, the truth will find its way out, even if some constellation of those people don't want you to know how to make your own soap or to take more serious cases, might not want you to know there are questions about Hunter Biden's laptop right before an election or something like that. I think you do that, and then you also revitalize, think hard about updating some of the norms of journalistic integrity that are coming out of professional schools. And you've done about the best you can with media censorship. It's still going to happen, but the hope is that there's enough incentives that are cross-cutting that the most important things get out to the public when they need to.
Fantastic. So, JP, you've been very generous with your time. I do want to talk about this sort of the final two chapters of the book, which are different, of course, but they're related. So maybe I can ask, sort of roll two questions into one. You've got a chapter on social media platforms as venues for private censorship, and then also a chapter that I found really intriguing. I hadn't thought about the question very much myself, about search engines and what you call search censorship. I'll just add, tell us about these final two chapters of the book.
Yeah, great. So the social media chapter is the longest chapter. In some ways, it's the chapter that was most difficult to write, because so many developments were happening while I was writing. And one particular example is when I was preparing to hit send on the final draft of the manuscript in November of 2022. The Twitter files broke, and shortly before that, the details of the DSA, Digital Services Act, in the European Union were coming to light. Obviously, things are getting published all the time on these topics. It was hard to keep up.
Right.
So I think in the social media context, what we want to do is notice that social media platforms come in a lot of different varieties, and that the concerns about censorship and moderation that you might have about them aren't independent of those varieties. But it would take us kind of far afield to walk through a lot of the texture there. I won't do that, and I'll just hope people check it out and think about those issues about different kinds of platforms carefully when they're talking about regulating so-called social media, because it's not a monolith, right?
Right.
So more or less social media platforms employ moderation strategies of a couple of kinds. So one kind of moderation strategy that they employ is a kind of hard sanction. So if you violate their terms of service or their community guidelines, as they're often called, terms of service being something distinct from those, your post will be removed. It'll be deleted. Your account might be suspended or removed and deleted. But that's not the only sort of tool that social media platforms have. They also have tools to merely reduce what Elon Musk calls the freedom of reach of your content. And so you might not appear in the platform's search bar when you start typing in things and it suggests people and content for you. You might, your post might not appear to as many people. It might only appear to people who are saying similar kinds of things, and so on and so forth. Regardless of whether it takes the former or the latter form, I think that social media content moderation, if it's enacted for the kinds of reasons that I identify in my definition of censorship, will count as censorship. And then there's just a question of, you know, what should we think about that? And, you know, without detailing all of the arguments in a pretty long chapter, I'll just note three things. One thing is that lots of people think that social media platforms are the new public square. And so just as, in Marsh versus Alabama, Chickasaw, Alabama, a private town owned by the Gulf Shipping Company, was told you can't subject speech on your streets and alleyways to prior restraints without violating the First and 14th Amendments, so too should we think that social media platforms can't do that. And that's more or less because they serve now the same functional role that the old town square used to serve. And so the idea is something like, look, you aren't in town squares anymore. You're now on social media platforms. To the degree that they are now subjecting speech to their own idiosyncratic rules, that's wrong. They can't do that any more than Chickasaw could, any more than shopping malls could in a series of cases that ended up in large part actually overturned. And we need to recognize that. And this is a concern that you see people as different in their politics as Donald Trump and Nathan Robinson Jr.'s citing and making this sort of case. My own approach is to be pretty skeptical of this. I think that if you read the court decisions, it turns out that there's a very specific kind of thing going on in the Marsh case. So Justice Black wrote the opinion on that case. And what he noted was that, people have different rights if they live in company towns than if they live in ordinary municipalities. So if you live in Chickasaw, you don't have First Amendment freedoms to speak in your town square. If you live in, Boston, Massachusetts, you do. So invoking trespassing laws to force states to punish people for trying to exercise those freedoms implicates the state in violating the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And then you just notice that nobody lives on social media platforms. Nobody lives in shopping malls. Everybody who uses and doesn't use those platforms has the same rights from the light of the state. And there's just no 14th Amendment ground, I think, for being concerned. Right. Now you can say, look, these are big organizations. They are discriminating in a non-viewpoint. That is to say, their restrictions on speech aren't neutral of viewpoint. And they have a duty, given their size and public function, to refrain from viewpoint discrimination. But I think there, and this is the second thing I'll say, it's hard to understand how social media platforms can offer the product that they offer, which, as Gillespie has argued, is just moderation. This is a book called Custodians of the Internet, without engaging in some viewpoint moderation. And social media platforms that have tried to instantiate non-discrimination as a norm have found themselves, in effect, violating that norm pretty quickly as their platforms are flooded with bad content that they think they don't want to be hosting. And then the third thing that I'll say is, well, so sure, maybe it's the case that they shouldn't be stopped from moderating in a viewpoint sensitive manner, but should we think that actually a lot of the speech that happens on these platforms is quite dangerous, so that what we need to do is actually regulate the platforms in their efforts to moderate? And there too, I'm sort of skeptical. In principle, I'm not totally against this sort of thing, but I'm skeptical that there are First Amendment concerns, that we really don't know much about what we're doing in the content moderation space, and that we have a kind of unique opportunity to experiment with different moderation regimes and to study these platforms. And I think I would rather have the benefits of that experiment than secure whatever uncertain gains regulation might provide, except in certain kinds of limited cases that I specify in the book at various points. And then on search censorship, let me just say that, you know, the concerns are quite similar. The search engine Google controls a huge amount of the market for search. It's worth pointing out, of course, that market definition is really hard. But you know, if Google were to say, you know, completely remove links to the OUP landing page for my book, that would have a massive effect on my ability to get news about the book out there. And people think that because of Google's massive market share and the market concentration in search more generally, that this is an especially dangerous site of corporate censorship. And yet it is going to be a little bit different to specify what the search engine does to censor. I mean, there's this thought that one thing that they can do is just remove links that they don't like. But there's relatively little evidence that they've done this. I mean, one of the core cases of concern was this open letter by some doctors and other professionals during the COVID-19 pandemic called the Great Barrington Declaration. And people thought, wow, it's not coming up on the search engine at all. Google must be censoring it. I don't think that we ever got a really clear answer on what's going on there. But having done some web design myself and trying to optimize the keywords and such and links for so that it will come up on the organic list of search results relatively quickly, I know that this takes some time and that merely failing to appear early in the search results or even at all isn't necessarily a reason for thinking that there was anything untoward going on. But nevertheless, people have made the case that because of Google's market concentration, we should really be looking at antitrust remedies in this particular case. And one of the things that I just observed is that it's difficult to see how the traditional antitrust actions that we have available to intervene in monopoly cases is a monopoly power will solve the free speech problems. They might solve other kinds of problems, right? But like breaking up Google, if people are right that one of the grounds for breaking up Google is that that a search engine it's good to have just one dominant one because of economies of scale and network externalities and things of that nature, it's likely it's at least possible that you break it up and then a new dominant firm emerges and you haven't achieved very much in the process. And then if you're thinking about making Google some sort of a public utility or something like that, and subjecting it to common carriage regulations, then it's actually quite difficult to figure out how the regulation should look. And I think one of the things that I'm concerned about is that as the quality of Google search has, I think in many people's eyes, deteriorated, it's deteriorated because to some degree, this is speculative, but let me just say that one plausible explanation for why it's deteriorated is that it's stopped trying to maximize the match between the searcher's search terms and the information that it provides. And so I think there's a real worry that if we get this wrong, and if Google's having a hard time getting it right, that we wind up with actually a deteriorated information environment where it's difficult to find the kinds of things that are relevant for the kinds of questions that we have. And so I'm a little bit worried about that. I don't, at the end of the day, say you should flat out reject this proposal, but I want to hear more. And I think we need to be having a discussion about what good regulation of something like a search algorithm might look like. Who should undertake it? What are the incentives that they're subject to? How do we avoid, corporate capture of the regulatory apparatus to, sort of snuff out competition, and so on and so forth? I think these are big concerns that we've faced and failed to face adequately in earlier eras of common carriage regulation, with, effects that I don't regard as good effects. So that's a little bit. I know that we're on time of how I see the search censorship space.
Well, that's fantastic. So JP, we're at the end of our discussion, but I want to thank you for joining me on New Books in Philosophy. It's been really great to talk to you about the book.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me, Bob. It's been a great conversation, and it's been fun to talk about these ideas with you today.
Fantastic. Before we go, let's thank our listeners. Thank you for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. I've just been talking with JP Messina about his new book. It's out with Oxford University Press. It's titled Private Censorship. I highly recommend it. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.